Now, we have been all abuzz, of course, about energy and energy prices over the last while as our wallets took the hit because of Donald Trump's war in Iran. But with the future talking about wind energy, is it going to actually benefit your pocket in the long run? Well, let me explain.
Let me explain with Sean Defoe, a News Talk original.
Hello and welcome to the podcast, and thanks a million for joining us. Don't forget to like and subscribe wherever it is you're listening. Now, look, you will have heard people in government, people elsewhere saying wind energy, it is the way forward. And then on the flip side, you might well have heard Donald Trump saying wind is a disaster and was never going to lead to being the future. But really, the government here is buying into it. They said we could be the Saudi Arabia of wind and that the future is all offshore, some onshore as well, but offshore largely. But how is it actually going to work in long term? Like, how does all this building it, pricing it, is it going to benefit your pockets? And if we did have a wind-driven energy system, would we be safe from further shocks in the likes of the Middle East and other parts around the world that always seem to affect us quite badly when it comes to cost? Well, to discuss all of that, I'm joined by Noel Conniff. He is the CEO of Wind Energy Ireland. You're very welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much for having me, Sean. I'm looking forward to getting into it.
Yeah, so if it's just a starting point before we get into prices. If we were to take the forecasting out to just less than the next 10 years, 2035, the decade of wind that's kind of been promised, if we were to get to 2035 and everything had gone as planned, and we know planning's another thing we might get into later on, what percentage of Ireland's wind energy or total energy output would be wind at that stage?
So to give you a sense where we're at today, Sean, we have about 40% of our electricity coming from wind energy every single year. And that's been quite consistent for the last 5 years or so. We've grown wind energy very strongly over the past 20, 25 years here. That slowed down a bit in recent years as it took longer to get projects out of planning, as our energy demand increased with new energy users coming online with electrification of our economy. So we'd kind of plateaued at around that 40%. If we can keep building renewable energy, though, we could absolutely get towards about 60% renewable electricity by 2030, and then much higher than that in the early 2030s as more onshore wind, solar, and offshore wind comes online. You mentioned at the beginning around the pricing element, we're already seeing some of the benefits of wind energy in our electricity prices today. I'm sure we'll get into that.
Yeah, I just want you to maybe explain how the pricing works, because obviously there is the price that's generated and all this. But when it comes to the auctions, and people might have heard periodically the government announce an auction for offshore wind, what does that actually mean? How does that process work, and how might that affect into prices? Then we'll get into.
Yeah, so in your electricity bill, your electricity bill is made up of different components. And some of those, the largest component is the wholesale price. That's the price for the energy itself before you start getting into how you move that energy around the country, which is through our electricity grid. And there's grid charges there. And then there's supplier charges, and there's VAT on top of all of that. Where the auction process comes in is in relation to the price that you pay for energy. So over the past 100 odd years since we've had electricity in Ireland, the price for energy has typically been set by the fossil fuel generators that we had available at the time, be it oil or gas or coal. But over the last 20 years, we're starting to connect more and more renewables, and that's helping to push off the most expensive fossil fuels on our system. So there's two things that you'll hear about. One is the pricing on a day-to-day electricity. So that's traded every single day in the wholesale market, and that sets the wholesale price, which is the component within your bill at wholesale level. Renewables, though, are typically developed on different long-term contracts. It's almost like the wholesale market is a variable mortgage that moves day-to-day, Sean. But the auction price that you set in, it's like fixing your mortgage for typically periods of 15 to 20 years. That's the price that you pay for renewable electricity, for wind, from solar, be it onshore wind or offshore wind. Now, the government runs an onshore renewables auction every single year at about August, September every year. And how that works is that projects all around Ireland that have planning permission and a connection to the grid, they are eligible to bid into this auction. And the government says, okay, we're going to purchase this amount of renewable electricity in this auction. The maximum amount that companies are allowed to bid is X price, and we're going to take the most competitive projects. So that happens every single year. There's winners, there's losers, but ultimately the consumer benefits from the most efficient projects with the lowest bid prices in that auction. And then we
And what happens then if you are if you have a solar farm or something and you lose out in that auction? Can you not sell your energy, or how does that work?
Yeah, so it's almost like you've got finance then from the government, you've got support to know that you can construct your wind farm or your solar farm. So all of these projects, they wouldn't have been constructed yet. If you win the auction, you're guaranteed a fixed price for electricity for the next 15 years or so. That means that you have certainty on your revenue, and it allows you to then construct the project. So it would almost be like you go to the bank, you've got your deposit, which is put on contract, and you say, okay, now can I add a mortgage to go and build my wind farm or my solar farm? For anyone that doesn't win, their options are really to try to either wait for the next auction to see if there's anything you can do with your project to make it more cost effective, maybe negotiate with your supply chain to see if you can bring down prices. Or alternatively, what you could do is try to find a separate off-taker for your electricity. That's typically done through a mechanism called power purchase agreement with a large energy user. So you might have seen earlier this week, for example, there was an announcement of a new wind farm opening in Offaly by BNM, which was funded through Amazon with a PPA with Amazon. So in that situation, instead of going for a government contract for that wind farm, it went for a long-term contract with Amazon.
Okay. And when that price is agreed for 15 years, how competitive are those prices with, say, oil and gas prices, for example? And does that provide a maximum that can be charged? So is the long-term benefit to Joe Public and people who are buying their electricity of having more of this, okay, you might pay a rate that is, I don't know, equivalent, you tell me, to what oil and gas is charging at the minute, but if there's an energy shock, it's not going to spike massively in the way we've seen in recent months.
Exactly. So there's a couple of benefits to it. So to give you a sense of where the pricing is at for gas generation, Ireland doesn't have any coal or oil generation really on our grid anymore. It's predominantly gas. And since the Iranian energy crisis kicked off at the end of February, we've seen gas prices increase. Now, they haven't increased that to anywhere near the level that they did following the Russian invasion of Ukraine, but they still have gone up. In March, for example, the wholesale price on the days when we had the least amount of renewables available to bring that price down, so very reliant on gas generation, it was about 180 euro per megawatt hour. That compares then to today's when we had the most wind and solar available to push the expensive gas generation off a grid, and the price came down to about 94 euro. So that's one advantage. The renewable energy decreases the wholesale price. Now, in the auction that we've seen over the last few years for onshore wind, offshore wind, solar energy, prices are typically coming in the region of about 90 to 100 euro. And that's fixed then for that 15 years. So it's coming in right now about half the price of the most expensive wholesale market days when we're reliant.
What happens then after that 15 or 20 years? Because that's great for the first while of the project, but are we then going to have a situation where if we build a load of offshore wind, that after 20 years or whenever that auction ends, whoever is running that can charge what they like?
Well, in that situation, they then actively participate in the day-to-day market. So they will bid in a price, but given that they've recovered the cost building their wind farm by that point in time, they'll be heavily incentivized to bid quite low in the market in order to make sure that they're generating energy day to day. Like we see it across Europe, where older wind farms, older solar farms that have reached the end of their government contracts, they're really depressing the wholesale price right across the continent, really. And more and more we're seeing evidence where countries that are reliant on renewable electricity, hydro, wind, solar, they have the cheapest electricity prices in Europe. I think the really good thing wind energy and solar energy is it brings that price stability. We're going through our second fossil fuel energy crisis in less than 5 years now. We know the pain that that has brought to families and businesses right around Ireland and the uncertainty of energy costs. The good thing about moving to a predominantly renewable-based electricity supply is that you have price stability. You can almost guarantee year on year on year what your electricity costs are going to be, and you're not worried about what might happen halfway around the world in an area that we have no control over.
Mm. What's the average lifespan for, say, an offshore wind farm? Because they may have recovered that initial cost, but I presume there's upkeep, there's replacement after, I don't know, X amount of years.
Yeah, so I would say, so maybe just to break down a sec. So for Ireland, we only have a single offshore wind farm currently that was built in 2004, and that's actually going through the decommissioning process. Where it reached its end of life after about 20 years, 22 years of operation. That was one of the first in the world at the time. So it was really, Ireland was a world leader when it came to offshore wind energy at a point in time. But unfortunately, we didn't progress beyond that. Our next generation offshore wind farms that we're currently working through our planning system, the first of those will be built about 2030. They will have a lifetime of about 30 years. So the technology has moved on, but that wind farm, once it's built in 2030, should still be generating electricity in the late 2050s. For onshore wind energy, which is where we currently get 40% for electricity, this year we've actually just completed the decommissioning of Ireland's very first onshore wind farm in Bellacarrick, County Mayo. That was built in 1992 and that operated for 34 years. Before it needed to be decommissioned. So you're typically looking at about 30-year lifetime for an onshore or offshore wind farm.
And when you say decommissioned, is that total removal? Is that replacement? I mean, can you just, does all of it need to be removed? To what degree can the same spot then be used again? Because obviously, particularly with offshore, there's a huge amount of work under the water to make sure these things are stable, or else you have floating, whatever it happens to be. Like, is it a total busted flush you need to get up and move after the lifetime, or can you go again just with the cost of setting it up again?
So very often there's things that are, so there's two options to you. There's one that's called life extension, where you can take down components of the turbine and you can replace them like for like. You can extend the life of the project by maybe 10, 15, 20 years, or else there's a situation called repowering. And that's a situation where you utilize the exact same site, much of the same equipment that's already placed there, and you can typically get much larger yields of energy from the exact same site because you take advantage of the technology and how it's moved on. So just to give you a sense of things, that Bellacarrick wind farm that I mentioned earlier on, that had an output of 6 megawatts from over 20 turbines when it was built in the 1992. That's now being replaced by a single turbine, modern turbine, that can produce the exact same power output. That gives you a sense of how much the technology has moved on. So for onshore wind, which will be more the repowering closer to time, we're typically going to see the older turbines being taken down and replaced with fewer modern turbines to get the same or a larger power.
Wow, that's fascinating. Kind of makes me wonder then as well what 20, 30 years down the line when we're replacing these ones, how far that tech will have come. Talk to me then, Noel, about planning. How frustrating has the planning system been? Because I feel, and I'm sure a lot of people listening feel, like we've been talking about these offshore wind farms for absolutely years, and you're saying the first of them isn't going to be up and running for another 4 years.
That's right. I think we've really been taking offshore wind seriously in this country for about 5 years now. It was around 2019, 2020 when we started to look at, okay, we've talked about this for long enough, how do we actually start building these projects? Legislative change was required because up until then, given changes in our planning laws and EU laws over the last 20 years, it was no longer possible to actually apply for planning permission for an offshore wind farm. That all changed in 2021 with new legislation that was brought in. The government then ran its first offshore wind auction in 2023 that we've just spoken about, and it has since run a subsequent one at the end of 2025 also. That first batch of projects that went into the 2023 auction, there's five of those. Those are now in the planning system. So all of those would have been submitted for consent to on commissions and all that in 2024. They received very, very substantial further information requests on the projects, which they've been responding to for the last year or so. So that's where in the original planning submission, the commission, the planning commission came back and said, okay, we need more information on this, this, this. In many situations that required further environmental surveys to be carried out, they were not quick responses that were required. And some of the projects have now submitted those. Others are still undergoing those environmental surveys. Overall, we're hoping that the first project gets out of planning in September this year. The second project should get out of planning in November. But we've been looking at about a 2.5 year turnaround type there, which isn't great. And I think there's a lot of lessons that we've learned in the country for how we've approached this and the first time that we've gone through it. And that will hopefully then lead to much, much faster processes, procedures, decisions for the next batch of offshore wind farms, which should go into planning in about 2028.
Are you seeing some spurious objections or submissions? I mean, we've heard, I think the most recent was St. Stephen's Green, and it's someone in Athlone holding up that development. But then on the flip side, there were obviously very important and worthy considerations, like if you're building on Kish Bank or whatever, and the, you know, the fish who populate there, or whatever the other, like, there are legitimate concerns, I suppose, that need to be addressed. And then in other parts of the planning system, we've seen quite spurious ones. Is it the same with wind?
So I guess through this further information request process, APP are trying to cover all bases. They're trying to assess feedback that came in from the public and how to make sure when they make a decision on these projects, for good or bad, the decision is out as legally robust as possible, so that it doesn't, let's say, receive a positive planning grant, then end up in courts for 2 or 3 years while the legal talks is being progressed. Some of the information requests that have come back, I think, have been quite reasonable. Others have been, I would say, asking for information that could have been sought after the project enters into operation, or if there's certain things that would absolutely be exceeded best practice in standard European planning. So again, I think part of this is a learning process for the decision makers there and what they actually need to make a decision on a project. And then I would say as well, a lot of it comes down to resourcing the state agencies that need to feed into our commissions and all that to help them make decisions. Many of those agencies were simply not resourced up to deal with the scale of these projects and the timeframe that they needed to turn around information in. Each of these planning submissions would be in the region of maybe 10 to 12,000 pages of information. But when that lands on the desk for the National Park Wildlife Service, for instance, and you've got five of those projects that you need to assess, and you don't have a team around you to help do that, it's going to lead to situations where we're going to have delays. And that's what we've experienced, and hopefully we learn from.
Okay, so there is the this is all officialdom, I guess, that has been holding things up. But we could well get into a scenario where, when the public has its say, post planning being granted, that 2030 could easily become 2032, 2033.
I would say that all of the five projects that are currently working their way through the system have baked in a judicial review into it. I think we'd be pretty certain that all of the projects will be shut down, regardless. How we're going to put the decision in for a variety of reasons. On the positive side, I would say there that the government established a planning and environment board to try to deal with these type of situations in 2023. And over the past 2 years, we've seen decision timelines for judicial reviews on onshore wind projects accelerate dramatically. It would have gone from a situation where projects that have been waiting for low for maybe 3 years, 4 years, that typically being now within 12 months of the judicial review being taken. So if you look at the critical path of these projects being developed, if they get their planning consent in the second half of this year, let's say they build in a year for an inevitable judicial review, they can still be working away in the background on securing supply chain, working on their grid connection, entering into contract negotiations with ports, the only unfortunate thing is they will not be able to finalize or sign those contracts until the legal challenge is cleared. So if that quickly, it won't go on the path. However, if it's slow and it gets held up for several years, then it absolutely would become a critical path issue.
I think that's just remarkable that you have to bake that time in, and that it's a natural now part of the contract process, speaks to a lot of the problems of planning in Ireland. But no, listen, thanks so much for joining us on Let Me Explain. That's, I think, a really interesting primer on how that energy market works, and how hopefully when all of this is up and running in whatever it be, 10, 15 years to scale, we will be somewhat more immune to the shocks that we have seen over the last while. I know you're heading into the Oireachtas now to give them address as we're recording that. So thanks for taking the time and joining us on Let Me Explain.
No problem. Very happy to be here, Sean. And thank you.
Thanks a million. Now that is it for this episode. Let Me Explain. Don't forget to like and subscribe for more to come, including a special episode from Cameron Hill next week about the history of women's rugby in Ireland. Talk to you soon.